and welcome to Dissecting Philosophy with Dr. McDonald. In this episode, we have the fourth interview with Frank Ruda, lecturer at Dundee University in philosophy. And this time we cover and discuss the whole of part three of the Communist Manifesto. So overall, what do we look at as all the different various kinds of socialism? That is feudal socialism, petty bourgeois socialism, German or true socialism, bourgeois socialism, and then rounding off with a discussion of utopian socialism. So let's get stuck into it. Yeah, so let's just overall start with the question, why communism over socialism, especially since really part three is more or less, it reads overall as attacking socialism really, and all the different sorts of nitty grittiness that goes on. But really, I find part three history-wise really fascinating, because it goes through feudalism, it goes through all the bits and bobs and aspects of especially how things work in relation to just everyday people from a feudal aspect, and then works all just briefly through in a very general way, of course, to industrial period. And it's all really fascinating. So on the one hand, it's sort of saying, interestingly enough, how do ordinary people, on the one hand, how are they functioning in society? And then at the other hand, saying socialism isn't good enough, and here's the reasons why.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the interesting bits, so this is often read only as an historical account, right? Solely as if Marx was dismissive of, let's say, certain developmental stages, but I think it gives us a kind of, let's say, grid to understand problems with what at first sight can appear as an endorsement of an emancipatory or socialist position, right? And I think for this, it's almost like an exercise in what one could call ideology critique. What I mean by this is that Marx and Engels are very perspicacious and very detailed in indicating that not everyone who says, let me put it like that, socialism really means socialism, right? And they mean very different things depending on who articulates that with what interest in what situation, right? So Lenin will later basically endorse and basically basically make the following claim. If someone says freedom, always ask who is endorsing freedom, freedom to do what, and who is the one supposed to be able to do it, right? Because it means totally different things in totally different situations and contexts and for totally different agents. And I think what Marx and Engels here are doing in the third part of the Communist Manifesto is they provide us almost a kind of template of understanding why certain people start talking about socialism or emancipation, what the motivation is behind it, why it is not really about emancipation, but about something else that is articulated in that specific kind of endorsement, and how to unravel it, right? So I think this is the general remark, right? Always, so it's almost like they're saying, always remind yourself and recall that if people talk socialism means something very different. And this is why in the very end, they make this distinction even of critical utopian socialism and proper communism, one could say, right? Now, I think because this is almost like a grid for analyzing problems with different endorsements of emancipation or different endorsements of what seems to be a transformative or revolutionary or whatever emancipatory position, it is very helpful and even more contemporary than it looks at first sight. So certain positions can be recognized, I think, in the contemporary conjuncture. I have a couple of thoughts about this, and I think there are really interesting points to mine out and bring to the fore. Maybe we can just go, I mean, my suggestion would be maybe we go through the different positions to understand what Marx and Engels are analyzing and where they see let's say, the hidden motivations or the expressions of a certain interest that is kind of in contradiction with what is explicitly articulated when someone endorses socialism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. At least go for it. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So, like, they begin the entire first part with what they call reactionary socialism. That is, I think, already quite interesting. Because socialism can be, so the endorsement of socialism, they notice, can be a reactive gesture, a reaction against a certain transformation. The transformation they have in view that is reacted against or upon is the bourgeois revolution, right? So what we talked about earlier, the fluidification of everything, right? The constant revolutionizing. So Marx and Engels clearly indicated that the bourgeoisie only remains the bourgeoisie if it constantly revolutionizes the means of production and everything, right? The only thing it doesn't revolutionize is the bourgeois society, right? But everything within it must be constantly revolutionized, constantly transformed, constantly upscaled on some level. And maybe on another level, descaled and de-skilled, and right, there is even regressive revolution sometimes going on, because this is part of the productive process of the bourgeoisie. Now, this type of bourgeois revolution transforms previous feudal societies in which there was an aristocracy, right? So this is, and hence the feudal aristocracy feels threatened, right? They're dying out. They're losing not only their grounds, but I mean, it's a class about to disappear. And what they now are doing, and that is embodied in what Marx and Engels describe as feudal socialism, is you get aristocrats that try to form a liaison, a kind of bond of solidarity with the workers or the proletarians, right? That looks at first sight quite counterintuitive, right? Why should Prince Harry and an average, I don't know, coal worker, right? Whatsoever, right? Operate together and act. And why should? How could they? On what level could they be able to have a common interest? Now, Marx and Engels say the interest of the feudal aristocracy is to suggest that their type of exploitation was less harmful than the exploitation brought about by bourgeois society, right? So they're basically saying, well, of course, there was a stratified society and we were the kings, basically, right? And you were the workers, but the working conditions were less bad. You were not working in this kind of shit factories, right? We were giving you stuff sometimes, right? I mean, so we were good masters on some level, right? We cared for you. We treated you like dogs, but like, I don't know, dogs we liked, something like that, right?
Yeah.
And in this sense, they even can present themselves as Christians, right? They love people, right? They want to be on top of society. They want to be the dominant and governing class. That's clear. But at the same time, I don't know, they have good hearts. And this is why they preach Christianity and whatsoever, right?
Yeah, I like those bits. I like those bits specifically when it said, oh, Christianity is one of the easiest things to slip a bit of socialism into. I like that bit.
Exactly. So Christianity comes in handy if you're a feudal aristocrat and basically want to say, well, listen, we're all humans, right? We love each other. I care for you, right? But just be my servant and let's not just go down that bourgeois emancipation revolutionary factory road. The feudal aristocracy uses Christianity for the purpose of presenting themselves as good humans, right? They love their servants. Yet at the same time, this is just an instrument for basically saying, well, let's not go down the bourgeois revolutionary road, but because this will produce more immiseration, right? I mean, so shittier conditions for you than you would have if you just remained our servants. And one can see this is already inspired and articulated because the feudal aristocracy is threatened by the transformation brought about by bourgeois revolutions, right? Mm-hmm. French Revolution. This is what, I mean, and the aftermath of it. So it is reactionary socialism. It is basically a form where, right, a kind of sociality of masters and servants, right, a socialism where, let's say, there is a proclaimed kind of solidarity between the aristocratic masters and the rather peasant servants is proclaimed, but Marx and Engels are saying this is already a symptom that this is lost, right? This is totally lost, and this kind of solidarity is the last kind of, I don't know, last kind of exit they see, right? So their world is lost, the bourgeois world is there, bourgeois revolution transformed everything, and right now the only thing that they can do is they identify the working class or the proletariats. We can talk about if there's a distinction or not. They identify the two of them, or this agent, as someone who can help them if they could just be convinced that feudal societies weren't that bad after all, right? So that is the first reactive tendency. So the second one is the petit bourgeois socialism. And I think this one is really, really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I found the petty bourgeois one really interesting as well. Yeah,
because what we have here is another form. So it's also part of what they call reactionary socialism. So it's also a reaction to the bourgeois revolutionary restructuring, right? And so, what is the petty bourgeois socialism? Marx and Engels identify, let's say, a certain amount of middle classes, right? They oscillate between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. They're really scared of becoming part of the proletariats, right? They dislike that option.
Yeah.
They want to be part of the bourgeoisie, right? That is so, but they're not yet part of the bourgeoisie. Okay, so petty bourgeois socialism is articulated from a position of these kind of middle classes, right? I mean, they're oscillating between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. They're not part of the bourgeoisie, even though they want to be a part of the bourgeoisie, but it's not certain for them, right? There is no security that they belong to that. And there is a real danger that they will just drop and fall into the proletariat. And this is what they're really scared of. And now they're internally torn between these two classes, right? It is as if they embody, well, the middle, right? The very split between the two. And because they're like, as if in a shitty or mediocre version of Goethe's, there are two hearts in my chest, right? They have two hearts in their chest, right? One that they don't want, the proletarian one, and one that they really like, the bourgeois one, right? But they can't rip out the proletarian one. And this is why what they're doing is they're identifying, they seem to be critical, and this is what brings them to socialism. They're critical of what? Of the contradictions of bourgeois society. What is the contradiction of bourgeois society? The contradiction that manifests in the class antagonism between bourgeoisie and proletariat. That is between their two hearts, right? This is what I'm trying to say. So they're basically saying, it is bad that we have contradictions. Why is it bad that we have contradictions? Because we could be on the problematic side of these contradictions, right? We could be on the side of the proletariat, and we don't want that. Right, and because we don't want that, and this is now how their socialist impulse is nevertheless the articulation and manifestation of a reactionary class interest. Because how do we avoid? What do we do with the insight that bourgeois society produces contradictions, fundamental contradictions, and can only work through the production of these kinds of contradictions? Well, we need a restitution of the previous ways in which property was owned and products were produced and so forth, or even though there are new ways in which we're producing, so the bourgeois factory and so forth, ways in which we're producing, they nevertheless need to be framed in previous, almost feudal, pre-bourgeois, old property ways, right? Because why is that? Because they still offer some sense of security and certainty, right? So the petit bourgeoisie is that kind of class which always fears that it's no longer part of the bourgeoisie. Why that is very interesting, I think, even especially today, is because there is a French linguist, basically, but also social theorist. He's called Jean-Claude Mienert. And he coined an absolutely wonderful term, namely the term of the Sellerite bourgeoisie. Sellerite bourgeoisie. So he's basically, and what he means by that is that even if you're really well off in this life, and hence a bourgeois, the next financial crisis might ruin you. And what does that mean? That the bourgeoisie is no longer hereditary in the same sense as it was, let's say, in the 19th century, right? Rather, it becomes, being a bourgeois is your job, right? You are employed as a bourgeois. You are as if, right? This is what it means. And hence, this kind of class privileges are privileges that you can lose, as other people lose their jobs. And it is this insight into the non-stability, the non-security of the property relations, so of you being a bourgeois, right, that can turn you immediately into what Marx and Engels describe as petty bourgeois socialist. Why? Because you're saying, well, if I can lose all my property and I'm well off right now, right, I mean, I'm part of the salaried bourgeoisie, maybe we should stabilize the property relations and prevent, I don't know, immense finance speculation and so forth, because I have my self-interest that I want to remain in the position and stay in the position, right, economically and socially where I'm at. Right? And I think that this is still very pertinent. There is this kind of, let's say, petit bourgeois mentality that one can see each cropping up each time, just like emerging each time when a part of the bourgeoisie feels threatened of losing their class privileges. And I think the Sellerite bourgeoisie term that Milner introduced indicates that if you're not what nowadays I think at least new papers call the super rich, right? The 1% who own ridiculously and ridiculous amounts of global property. If you're not belonging to them and just are, well, rich, you can't feel threatened by that. And hence, the interesting bit of that is that this can petty bourgeois you, right? If that were a verb, right? I mean, this can happen. And the attitude is that then you're starting to talk about contradictions, and your solution is always, let's say, more stability on the side of property, right? Or an inhibition to, or a reframing of new forms of production and trafficking of goods in old property relations, right? The internet, for example, is a good example, right?
Yeah.
So you want to own shit in the old way, even though there's the internet, right? Intellectually, for example. I think that is the second position, and one can clearly see why it's reactionary. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think it was key that we also distinguished the fact that the super rich are still completely unaffected by it all as well. And there's also there's also that hereditary wealth as well that's still obviously a factor that separates it out, because, of course, there's still aristocracy and so on. So, yeah, but obviously, except from the minority of the minority who are absolutely fine, everybody else still has very much that lingering horror of, wait a minute, what was that about, upcoming financial crisis again?
Yeah, precisely, totally. Yes, exactly. Right, I mean, you earned just a bit while brutally investing with Bitcoin, but Tom, 100,000 or 5 million may just be gone in a minute, right? Or just someone steals it, because, I mean, it all seems semi-corrupt anyhow. Right? I mean, so I think this is kind of the sentiment, and it's an indication of a certain kind of instability that even affects, let's say, here, the middle class that are not fully bourgeois, but the parts of the bourgeoisie that are not fully bourgeoisie, let me put it like that. Okay, the third position that they introduced, and I think this is also very interesting, is the German or the true socialism, right? The true socialism. It's still part of what they identify as reactionary socialism. And I think, so it is kind of what they describe as a critical position, which is kind of castrated by being transformed into a purely theoretical position, right? So
what I read about that is that what I found fascinating with this part was that it took upon, as it says, sort of aspects of the French Revolution, but then theorized it completely. And I think the words are sort of took the heart out of it, was I think roughly what they were trying to say.
Yes, exactly. And what does that mean? I think there is a model for this. There is an absolutely wonderful book by a friend of mine, a Canadian philosopher and comparative literature theorist, Rebecca Comey. The book is called Morning Sickness, and it's on Hegel and the French Revolution. And I think what she describes there when she deals with Hegel's treatment of Kant is very similar to what Marx and Engels are describing here. Don't worry. I'm gonna make it as clear as possible. So I think so Hegel describes in one of his famous books, The Phenomenology of Spirit, he gives an account of the French Revolution and why the French Revolution practically turned out to be using and could not avoid using terror even against the revolutionaries, right? And why was that? Because the concept of freedom, this is Hegel's claim now, that the French revolutionaries had in mind and wanted to realize was a concept that was freed and thus liberated from all determinations. Right. So they did not want any social or natural or gender-based or whatever kind of determinations, they all need to be negated or done away with. Now, the problem that Hegel sees is that is a purely negative kind of action, right? So you negate all the determinations of freedom to free freedom of everything that makes freedom unfree, right? Because all determinations, that was the assumption, make freedom unfree. Now, what is the problem with that, and where does the terror emerge? The terror emerges and is directed against the very authors of that concept of freedom when you realize that saying freedom should not have any determination is itself a determination of freedom, right? That you can't get rid of that, right? And this is where it becomes terrorist now and keeps on somehow spiraling out of control and intensifying, right? The more you want to get out all determinations and negate all determinations, the more you reintroduce them, and hence the terror becomes more brutal. Now, what did the Germans get when the French got the French Revolution? Well, the Germans got a philosophical revolution, and the name for that was Immanuel Kant, right? It was the Copernican Revolution, in fact. And what did Kant do? Well, he came up with an account of morality that, in some sense, this is now Rebecca Comey's claim, internalized the terror of the French Revolution. Why? Because the moral law for Kant keeps demanding more and more the more you obey it. Right? The more you're trying to be a moral person, the more the moral law is terrorizing you internally.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think what's great about if you internalize Kant's categorical imperative, the more comedic it becomes. It's like it's like a great example is Monty Python's Minister of Silly Walks, that if you just hit that as a categorical imperative to walk and do duty, the more and more obscure and absurd it becomes. Yeah.
Exactly. So because it is not that the moral law says, well, obey me once and then you're off for the weekend, right? But you obey the moral law once, and then the moral law says, well, you obey me constantly. Why didn't you reflect morally when you decided what to eat, when to take a shit, when all these kinds of things, right? Everything becomes a question of morality. I mean, totally. This is literally the case. And hence, the more you obey it, the more it is terrorizing you, right? I mean, Freud will later call that superego. The superego is the sadistic agency inside of you, your type of subjectivity that keeps on demanding more the more you obey. What does that mean? Well, we get real society transforming terror in France. We get philosophical form of abstract moral terror in Germany, right? I think something very similar is going on when Marx and Engels are talking about true socialism or German socialism. They take up ideas that are brought into the world, and this is why it's part of reactionary socialism, right? So the French Revolution, bourgeois revolution, demands freedom and equality, right? Inter alia. And What we get is in the German version is a philosophicization, a philosophical sublimation, of this very position, into basically saying, well, freedom and equality are eternal values that, irrespective of the context, and irrespective of the concrete situation, and irrespective of the development of a society and its productive forces and everything, are always valid. Always valid, right? So in this sense, what came to the fore with the French Revolution, with the bourgeois revolution, is translated. And this is literally what Marx and Engels are saying. It's an act of translation. Into a dehistoricized, so what appeared in a historical event is translated into something which is dehistoricized, so not historical anymore, which is thereby totally abstract and seems to be talking about action, right? Freedom, equality, and so forth, but has nothing to do any kind of practical effectivity anymore. And I think this is interesting because it is a reaction to a transformation of society, whereby you basically can start proclaiming in theory, right, that we need to conceive of equality and whatsoever, as long as you never find a practical equivalent what you identify in theory, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about an equal organization of equals, for example, a philosophy of action that would bring it into practice. And then you look at what is happening in the world and you're basically saying, well, no, that's not it. No, that's too bloody. No, that's too destructive. No, there are punks involved. No, there are anarchist tendencies. No, there are too military whatsoever, right? So the idea is this is what abstraction or dehistoricization means. You turn them into abstract values so that you can always go, this is not it, right? And thereby, it is a reaction to a transformation happening in France with the French Revolution that is socialist in discourse, right? It loves talking about equality and social organization, but only such that it can always disqualify whatever concrete political action and movement as not being up for the task, right?
Mm.
And hence, you have always an excuse why you're not participating. It's a very comfortable position.
Yeah. I had a good funny example that went out of my head as well, but it's precisely those points what we said. It's kind of like goes back into what we said before about Marx's own, you know, the stereotypical thing to do with Marx and revolution in itself. Is it now? Is it now? Is it now? And it's always that sense of it gets stuck. Or it's a car driving example. If you get stuck solely on a theory without actually doing your practical, you're not actually driving the bloody car. And that's the whole problem, is that you have to do both, basically. There's a bit of give and take. You can't do one solely. You can't just solely have driving without the theory, and you can't have theory without the driving. So you need both, basically. That was
it. And also, I mean, also the strange thing, right? I mean, the interesting move is you translate a practical experience into theory, right? So practically, something practically happened in the French Revolution that is then sort of translated into a theoretical reflection on basic values that are valid always, right? And give us orientational and guiding principles and so forth, which you then find totally untranslatable into practice.
Right? Yeah.
So you cut off what you won from practice, from the very practice from which you, which allowed you to generate it. And it's a kind of what Freud would call a defense mechanism against practice, right? And in this sense, it's like academic radicalism, right? It's so cool to have wonderful radical concepts that you will never have to prove in the real world or whatsoever, right? I mean,
yeah.
If someone asks you for an example, you can't give one. It's always not there, always to come or whatever, right? I mean, this is a ridiculous, I think, ridiculous position that in a sense is flags or tries to identify itself as socialist or as emancipatory or whatsoever you want to call it, but is de facto a defense mechanism against anything happening in practice, right? So theory sometimes, I think this is the important insight. Theory sometimes can hinder and can work as a defensive shield against practice itself, right? If you have a theory that tells you why you don't need to be practically engaged, perfect theory, right? I mean, it's very comfortable.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I mean, you don't need to be a militant then or whatever, right? I mean, you just can go on and relax because your theory gives you a good conscience about that. So, and I think, so these three forms, feudal socialism, petit bourgeois socialism, and German true socialism. Why true? Because it's an insight into the true basic ordinance of what socialism or egalitarianism would look like. That's the first bit, reactionary socialisms, reactions against the transformation of society. So we'll move on to, because surprisingly, there is also what Marx and Engels described as a conservative, or more specifically, and I think this is an interesting paradox, as bourgeois socialism. So the very revolution, right, the very agent of the transformation of society, the bourgeoisie, that transforms society into a bourgeois society, right, develops also a kind of socialism. But this one is obviously not reactive, because it's not reacting externally or whatsoever against the transformation implemented and brought about by the bourgeoisie, but it's a socialism that is generated by the very bourgeoisie that transforms society, right? And I think that's also a very, very interesting kind of phenomenon. Should we move to that, or I mean,
I mean, what I found particularly bourgeois socialism the most interesting bit out of part three, specifically because it touches upon all those key ways in which you can relate into contemporary society and how essentially you end up with bourgeois education and things like that. So yeah, let's totally kick into it.
Okay, wonderful. I mean, I very much agree. It is one of the most contemporary resonating, I think, descriptions that they give. So what is bourgeois socialism? Bourgeois socialism, or conservative socialism, as they also call it, is the sentiment, the desire, the wish, as they literally say, that emerges and appears in a part of the bourgeoisie about the misery and poverty and horrors produced by bourgeois society. So let me put it differently. The bourgeoisie can feel bad about the world it generated. And what happens when that happens? Well, I think Marx and Engels give quite an interesting description, because let me just quickly read this to indicate, yeah, sure, let's say, the political explosivity or explosiveness of that part. So he says, to the part of bourgeoisie who feels bad about all the grievances that bourgeois society generates belong, I quote, economists, philanthropists, humanitarians, improvers of the condition of the working class, organizers of charity, members of societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals, temperance fanatics, hole and corner reformers of every imaginable kind. So, and I think this is really, really interesting, because the bourgeoisie, feeling bad about the world it generates philanthropists. And what are philanthropists? Philanthropists are bourgeois who have a clear interest in the existence of the bourgeois world, because it's their world, right? Who at the same time feel bad about aspects of the world that they believe, and this is now crucial, that can be fixed without transforming the bourgeois world into another world, right? So that means, think about contemporary philanthropists. They're all just, like, on some level, ruthless entrepreneurs or financial speculators and so forth, right? All of them. At the same time, they donate a lot of money to charity. Why? Because they dislike it that there is poverty and grievance, social grievance and misery in the world, right? Yet at the same time, well, they are And now we're talking super rich, right? I think this is really important. So the super rich sometimes feel much better about the world that they co-generated and co-reproduce if they act in such a way that the very misery that they produce and that they identify as, let's say, not essential to the bourgeois world, but contingent, arbitrary, an arbitrary product, and try to fix it.
Yeah, sorry, I was just, no, it's okay. I was just thinking, and there's a fantastic example of Sacha Baron Cohen in the movie Bruno, and it specifically he highlights the giving of charities and the way in which celebrities give to charities is that, oh, they have a vast quantity of sums of money, but what are they going to do with it? They're going to do all the vants of, you know, all the good works and so forth that they can do with the money.
Yeah, exactly. So the moment, right? I mean, so the moment, so the very idea that you philanthropically give back what on some level you, I mean, I wouldn't say, well, maybe one could say what you stole before, right? It creates an interesting cycle because it allows you to continue doing what you do and even feel good about it, right? Because you're trying to fix something, some evil in the world, right? So you can be a ruthless financial speculator, ruining the existence of whomever, but at the same time, you can be without any problem a humanitarian. I think this has been endlessly analyzed by someone like Slavoj Žižek, who even basically indicated that this becomes kind of a marketing principle, even for, I don't know, certain products. You go to Starbucks and then you buy water and it indicates, right, I don't know, 30 cents or £1 from a bottle that is a bit more expensive goes to some kid in, I don't know, in South America and whatsoever. And hence you're participating in that kind of charity thing, which is therefore interesting because you're buying more expensive products, right, just to feel better consuming, right? And you feel even active, right? We're activists without ever being it. But I think the other interesting indication here is that that they're also speaking of those who are operating for the prevention of cruelty to animals. I think this is there is really something interesting here, because they're not saying that one should be cruel to animals, just to be totally clear, right?
But they're saying
that these kind of animal liberation movements are themselves a bourgeois reaction to the bourgeois way in which, let's say, food is produced, right? So it looks as if we don't have to mistreat animals per se, right? And hence we can fix it. But on some level, the bourgeois society is what is the reason behind us treating animals that badly, treating pigs worse than pigs and cows horrible. And right? I mean, so that is, I think, an interesting phenomenon, because it on the level of appearance, bourgeois socialism, so the activity of a part of the bourgeoisie that tries to fight the evils produced by bourgeois society can look as if it were political in the sense that it really wants to change something. Think about, I mean, I'm going to say something slightly provocative, but think about environmentalism, which is clearly a problem. And I mean, there is no doubt about that this is, that there is a problem. And there is no doubt about that this is the result of bourgeois society, right?
I mean,
capitalism, right? I mean, one would be blind if one weren't to clearly see that. Yet at the very same time, if there is a bourgeois environmentalism, and the bourgeois environmentalism, right, basically tries to deal with the problems, the environmental evils and grievances produced everywhere, without connecting this kind of transformative desire, transformative wish, with the insight that one can only deal with that if one transforms bourgeois society, right? So this, and I think this is the interesting thing of with regard to bourgeois socialism. Bourgeois socialism is a way of the bourgeoisie, of us all, if you wish, to react to problems in the world without reacting really to problems in the world.
Yeah, it's like putting a plaster on it, basically. Or there's a good example, a British example. I don't know, I just run it under a cold tap. You know, I never actually went to the doctors. I never got it properly analyzed. I just run it under a cold tap. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah. So exactly. I mean, one could say it's action without action, right? When you're just like fake acting, right?
I mean, it's doing the absolute bare minimal possible to actually address the fundamental problems that's actually going on. But in some way, what sort of comes out is potentially, as people listen along to this and becoming very aware, that on the one hand you have extremist groups like PETA, and you have all your regular vegetarian options at your supermarkets and so forth. It's not to knock any of those whatsoever, and to not say what anybody's doing is completely wrong, but rather to say what's being failed to address is a specific whole aspect of farming in and of itself. And that's what's the harmful thing, is that nobody's actually going after the chicken farms. Nobody's really attacking all the whole factory farm and whole aspect of it. And it's not something as simple as just buying the coffee at Starbucks, or just simply just buying your vegetarian meals. Even though it's still doing our part, it's not still fixing it out like it needs to be.
Exactly. Because sometimes, I don't know, the soya production is as harmful, right? Or can become a problem itself, right? And hence, it is not about, and you can easily see that. I mean, your examples were all I think very, very good ones. Because often it is less about actually changing the ways in which we produce, but generating new niche for consumption, right? I mean, if there are just like ones, and I have nothing against veganism, I think it's a great idea, right? I mean, but I'm not vegan, but who cares? I mean, right? But I'm saying I don't care what I literally don't care what the individual motivation is behind these kinds of decisions. But on the social on the total society level, I think the flexibility and dynamism of bourgeois society, always meaning capitalism, means you can very well be against the consumption of meat, and then you are just generating another bourgeois product, right? And you change nothing about the meat factories, right? Nothing. I mean, and hence, what happens there if you buy the stuff that is just a new product, which does not effectively change anything? Well, you feel better about it. Right?
Yeah.
And this is bourgeois socialism. That is bourgeois socialism. You get the impression that you changed something about society, which didn't change anything about society.
What I think is fantastic is Coca-Cola in the midst of all this, is that specifically Coca-Cola are that good as a company. They work at the unconscious level of wanting the Coca-Cola. So even without you even at a conscious awareness of wanting it, because of all the unconscious things of, oh, it's great for the family, it even creates world peace, I think was one of the advertisements. It's got all these good connotations to it. It's the next time you see it, you just automatically go for it. And that's where it starts to get really dangerous, I think, when it goes into those unconscious desiring processes of it as well.
Because also, I mean, there are epistemological problems linked to it, right? I mean, I recently saw, I forgot what that was. So I recently saw a car advertisement on German television. I think it was for a BMW, but I'm not sure. And it basically indicated that the new generation of BMWs just run up. They run on a type of energy that makes it almost into your individual responsibility to buy that car if you don't want the environment to go down, right? And so that was kind of the message. And I thought, I mean, and that was kind of interesting, because it turns environmental problems from social and political problems, that is, problems that concern the overall organization of society, into individual consumer choices.
Yeah.
And this is the problem with the new products in the supermarket. I'm totally fine with everyone buying vegan sausage. I really don't give a fuck. But but you get my point, right? I mean,
totally.
It displaces the level of problem visibility and problem articulation. This is why I think Marx and Engels are absolutely clear that the imaginary that stands behind it is what they describe as, so there is a part of the bourgeoisie which wishes that there is a bourgeois society without proletariat, right? I mean, let me put it differently. There is a part of people living in the West who wish there were no Africa, right? And no human rights violations and all that, and no wars, no Congo, and so forth. Because it is far more enticing and heartwarming to think that these things are not a necessary element of bourgeois societies, right?
There's actually an example that comes to mind. It's from the, it's a manga and anime, but it's called One Piece. And it's basically the aristocracy actually have these little air bubbles on their heads, and they don't even like to breathe the air of other people. They only want to breathe their air of ultimately the aristocracy. And I think that just fits in absolutely perfectly with that example. It's like people that are, you know, like, oh, the poor, you know, it's those people.
So the idea is there is a part of bourgeois society that does not like the truth of bourgeois society that is embodied in the misery and the evils it produces. Therefore, it imagines a world, a bourgeois society without these evils, right? Bourgeoisie without the proletariat. And it believes, and this is now the means of how to get from the first to the second, that one can do this by applying what Marx and Engels call administrative improvements. But administrative improvement. So reform somehow. We need, do some slightly different debt politics with regard to Africa, give micro credits to people in India, shit like that, right? But the assumption is, and this is why it is from Marx and Engels' perspective, deeply problematic. Because the idea is one can change things without changing things. It is similar to solving the problem without solving the problem, right?
You
get the idea. Well, let's just not have all that misery and evil. Let's change things, but let's not really change society because, I mean, it is still a bourgeois socialism, right? And how do you do that? And I think then they have one really interesting, I just wanted to single that out, example, and that is tariffs, protective tariffs. Think Trump. Protective tariffs, that they're what they're talking about. Why protective tariffs? Because this is the way in which the bourgeoisie, feeling bad about the misery that it itself generated, wants to protect the working class through the implementation of tariffs. Right? This is a bourgeois socialist strategy. Not saying it's socialist, but right, I mean, it is the part of the bourgeoisie that feels bad about its own product, but also that can be, and I think this is why I'm saying, wanted to point that example out and point to Trump, because this can also be mobilized to dilute parts of the working class, to speak Marx and Engels' language, into believing that this is actually progressive, that this is, right? I mean, as much as if you care about the environment, and how could you not, you can believe that becoming an environmentalist and not also thinking about the fundamental transformation of bourgeois society is enough. Similarly, you can think, well, protective tariffs, that is a great idea. It's in the interest of the working class, right? But it is not. I mean, that is important, because what does bourgeoisie socialism try to protect? The bourgeoisie, right? Yeah, this is totally. Why Trump was not a revolutionary, right? He was not a working class guy. And so, I mean, but it's important because it is so enticing and seductive. This is why philanthropists seem to be good people. They are not. Right. This is why it seems to be important to be against animal cruelty and for the environment. And it is important, but it's not enough. Right? But you see, I think this is the dilemma that Marx and Engels are analyzing. And I think these are dilemmas that are very well and still with us. Right. I mean.
Yeah, totally.
OK, so it is the way in which the bourgeoisie claims it is ultimately only working to protect the interests of the working class, right, on some level, which is not true de facto, There is then another form, and maybe we can, I'm going to be shorter and more condensed on that one. There is then what they call, that's the third position. So first reactionary socialism, then bourgeois socialism, which is not reactionary because it's a kind of, let's say, self-delusion or operative illusion or certain kind of ideology which presents, which comes, springs or originates in the bourgeoisie as a way of endorsing the bourgeois world and the and by producing the idea that one can transform bits of it without transforming all of it. And the third now is what they call critical utopian socialism. And the critical utopian socialism, I think, is interesting because it is a position that basically does not only want to improve the life of the working class, but the life of everyone, right? The life of everyone. Mm. So it is, and why? Because it sees that there is something wrong in contemporary society. And how do they think that this can happen? They generate an ideal society, and they generate what Marx and Engels call the best a possible plan for the best possible society, right? And this is addressed to everyone, right? It is, it's similar to, let me put it like that, a situation which is what Habermas would call an ideal communicative situation, right? Where we're just there as humans, right? Not as members of a certain class, not involved in our political interests, but we just have to agree that the society where we're all equal and we're all living, I don't know, a bit more ascetically, right, and more returning to the essentials and whatsoever, that this is very desirable. And now comes the catch. But who is this vision of a new society, of a new utopian society addressed to? Well, to the bourgeoisie and the powerful. Who else should change that, right? And this shows, and this is what is annoying Marx and Engels, this shows that the utopian, critical utopian socialists, so they're critical of present society, they're utopian because that is their solution. The solution is addressed to the powerful and the rich, right? You need to talk to Bill Gates if you really, or right, to Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk if you really want to change something. I mean, sometimes German social democracy sounds like that, right? I mean, really, I mean, yeah. They're powerful. We need to listen to their voices simply because they're super rich, right? I mean, that is kind of the idea behind that. And they're ridiculing this position because it's also not properly what they call communist. Why? Because it does not believe that the people who are actually the reason for the reproduction of bourgeois society, so the working class, that they could change anything, right? So they think bourgeois society only, this is what they identify, this is why it's a very contradictory position. They identify, they think, yes, bourgeois society produces evil. This evil or misery, this evil is, and misery is embodied in a class that is the working class. But the working class can't change their own conditions. It can only be changed if we give the right vision of society to the really powerful and so forth, right? And this is why they're not really, in this sense, communist, because they still believe the only revolutionary force is the bourgeoisie. They don't see that the bourgeoisie produces ultimately, as they say at one point, its own grave digger, right? Unbinding emancipatory political forces that exceed their own control, right? So it is in disbelief of the working class. And this is why Marx and Engels say, well, this type of utopian, critical utopian socialism, this emerges when during the time where, let's say, the class antagonism and the class, let's say, self-identification, right? So the insight about one's position in society, right, and into the overall structure of society is not yet fully articulated, right? So it still believes the powerful are just the powerful, right? And why can they believe that? Because they follow their framework, their vision is framed by the bourgeois idea of power.
Mm.
So they see through bourgeois eyes, and what they see through bourgeois eyes is misery and they dislike it. But they also see that the only ones holding power are the bourgeois, right? The super rich and so forth.
I think a nice simple way to put it is Imagine a situation in which it's suddenly everybody should drink tea, and that's a very bourgeois thing. And then suddenly everybody drinks tea, and then that's a nice utopian version of, yeah, nice little society, all chilling out, having a nice cup of tea. It's quite as simple as that as well. It's just this one idea, ideality or ideal plane, yeah, in which it's this utopian plane. Everything's all lovely, but who's the one that's constructing the adverts to be advertised is the bourgeois, and so they're going to give you a little slice. See, this is where I find the bourgeois so interesting as well as the topics, because it always gives the proletariat just that nice little slice of bourgeois life in the midst of it all. Just that little cup of tea or that little cup of coffee, that's what the proletariat are going to get, just that little slice of bourgeois life.
But you see, the interesting bit here is that the best possible plan for the best possible society sounds like a neutral plan, right?
Yeah.
But don't forget the first sentence, like that the history of all societies has thus far been the history of class struggle, right? There is no neutral position and plan, right? It's always in the interest of one of the two classes in which all the class differences are right now condensated, right? After the bourgeois revolution, so bourgeoisie proletariat. So everyone who's saying, I just have a neutral proposition for a better society, you're either endorsing the bourgeoisie or the proletariat, right? And,
yeah,
and hence, if you're addressing the bourgeoisie as the ones who can implement that best possible plan for a best possible society, you're basically very much flirting with the bourgeoisie, right? Because you're not, even though you're trying to actually and take sides with the proletariat, but you're not thinking, as Lukács will, Georg Lukács will later say, from the standpoint of the proletariat. And I think this is what Marx and Engels are trying to indicate here. Because, and recall our brief discussion of the position of the communists vis-a-vis all kinds of fractions of, right, the other political parties. They're not a particular fraction. They're just the articulation of the interest of the proletariat, right? And what it gives the interest of the proletariat a universal and internationalist form, right? Mm. That is to say, all previous positions that we discussed was unable to think properly from the perspective of the proletariat. But the perspective, the standpoint of the proletariat, is the only perspective where one can actually see what structures society.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll leave this for maybe next go, because I think this is starting to be really the key problem of how do you think proletariat style? And we started to develop it out previously. And as soon as we start to delve into that, we're just going to delve into a fresh new topic. But I think also, just to round us off, I think we can also discuss this next time. Isn't this also a criticism of how communism emerged? Was it not more in a style of bourgeois socialism rather than communism? I mean, that's arguably in which, you know, every way in which it got implemented, essentially, it goes back into exactly the same forms of government and state and structure and all that has it done previously. So it's possibly an idea that we can eke out next go, definitely.
I agree. Let's do one roundup session on how does one think from the position of the proletariat. Talk about the distinction between working class and proletariat, if there is one or not, right?
Yeah.
And dive a little bit into what we also wanted to address at one point, namely the history of Marxism on some level, right? The history of the realization and the problems with the realization of that.
Yeah, totally. That sounds perfect. So that was an absolutely fantastic discussion with Frank. Let's go over some key points that we covered and also just some interesting points that I thought would be good to highlight again. So in part 3, Marx and Engels provide us with a template for why certain people talk about socialism and the motivation behind it. Feudal socialism uses Christianity as a way of showing themselves to be good human beings. Petty bourgeois are the middle classes that fear of becoming part of the proletariat and want to become part of the bourgeoisie. The petty bourgeoisie always fears that it will no longer be part of the bourgeois, fear of losing all their class privileges, because they can lose all their property, the desire to stabilize it and ultimately make structure and so forth all stable, true socialism is purely theoretical and untranslatable into a practical situation. It is academic radicalism, concepts that you never have to prove in the world. Kant's categorical imperative is the way in which the terror from the French Revolution terrorizes our lives. Bourgeois socialism is where the bourgeois feel bad about the world that it generated. They believe that it can be fixed without transforming the bourgeois world into another world. It allows for the mobilization of people into making them believe that it will do good things. And utopian socialism looks to improve the lives of everyone, and it generates an ideal society, the best possible plan for the best possible society, and it's critical of contemporary society. So, in the next episode then, we'll continue on with our fifth interview with Frank, covering those topics of how exactly can we think in a proletarian way, and also touching upon the history of Marxism. So feel free to drop me an email at my address at dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com. Tip me a coffee at coffee.com/dissectingphilosophy, ko-fi.com/dissectingphilosophy. Check out the Patreon page where we've got currently the full discussion of Slavoj Žižek's Pandemic 1, and we're now covering Pandemic 2. And the first episodes of those are completely free, with each subsequent episodes of those series needs a £5 or your regional equivalent subscription. And lastly, I can be found on Twitter at IAmARubberMan. Many thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time.